This podcast includes graphic depictions of true crime cases and may contain explicit language. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, this is Robin.
This is Jackie.
And this is Amanda.
And you are listening to We Saw the Devil, a podcast dedicated to horror, true crime, and all things macabre. If you want to follow us between shows, don't forget to check us out online. You can go to our website at www.wesawthedevil.com. You can follow us on Instagram at We Saw the Devil Podcast or on Twitter at We Saw the Devil. And if you want to follow specific co-hosts' social media, you can find the links to those on our website as well. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of We Saw the Devil. This is Robin.
And this is Jackie.
And tonight I decided to do a case that I've actually been fairly obsessed with for the last few years. This case has lesbians, it has incest, it has class warfare, and it has lots of... it's certainly something. So if you don't know, I have a degree in both French and political science. So early in my college days, I rented a movie called Sister, My Sister. It was French, the video store had it, and it looked pretty interesting. And I was just, you know, trying to work on my French language skills. And it was crazy. I mean, shocked, really. This was, God, probably like 12, 13, 14 years ago. And I wasn't aware that it was based on a true story until probably the last 5 years or so.
What attracted you to even rent it? Like, it was it the cover or?
I just.
Tell me.
I don't even remember the cover. Actually, I didn't even rent it. One of my friends did. I was sick. One of my friends did and brought it home. And we watched it over a weekend. And neither one of us knew what to expect. And so suffice it to say, we were both. It made for a really uncomfortable viewing.
Oh, really?
Had you heard of it, Jackie?
Actually, no. I have been completely unaware, other than you having episodes of Cold Sweats at night and talking about how you need to record this. I have been unaware. I've gone in my waking life not knowing what it's like to see sisters. incestuous murderous sisters.
So tonight's episode, we are doing the Pepin sisters. They're relatively well known, but there just isn't a lot of information out there. It was a huge deal in France when it occurred. And I see that there's some publications around, but definitely it's a crazy, crazy case. And I think that a lot of true crime podcasts and a lot of people discount it because the body count isn't terribly high. It's not like, you know, the Ted Bundys, the John Wayne Gacys, the Dahmers, anything like that.
No, don't downplay it. No, don't downplay it because you're going to turn people off. Don't. Hey, there's something like this is messed up. Let's not play it like that.
It is pretty messed up. I am going to tell the story of Christine and Léa Pepin. But before we get into that, I would like to give a shout out and big thank you to all of our patrons from our Patreon. We have Iris and Ian, our executive producers. And then we have Shauna, Derek, Nikki, Amy, and Gwendolyn.
We super appreciate it. And we do put a lot of hard work, effort, and money into this. So any contributions are greatly appreciated.
Indeed. And I understand that the world is falling apart right now. Big condolences. I hope that none of you guys are affected by the coronavirus. I hope that you and your family, everyone is safe. That being said, I understand that not everyone is in the financial situation to support art or podcasts or, you know, things that they enjoy. So we would also really appreciate it if you would take just a few seconds out of your day and leave a review on iTunes, because that's one of the biggest markers for podcasts, and it would absolutely mean the world to us in more ways than one. And if you want to check out our Patreon, you can find it at patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil.
We Saw the Devil.
Other than that, please check us out on social media. Our Instagram is We Saw the Devil Podcast. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at We Saw the Devil. And email us, as always, if you have questions, concerns, corrections, suggestions. You can email us at wesawthedevil@gmail.com. All right, so let's get to it. Let me set the scene. So the year is 1900, and we're in the city of Le Mans, France. And yes, that is the city. Jackie, you would know more about it than I do, but it's that like really grueling 24-hour car race they have that goes around like really, really narrow switchbacks.
Oh, is it? Oh, yeah. They portray it all the time in racing games.
Yeah, too. Exactly.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah, that is my worst nightmare. So point of reference there. So we're in Le Mans, France in the year 1900. Enter Clémence Dere and Gustave Papin. They're dating, but they are terrible and toxic. The relationship pretty much consists of sex, arguments, and just utter toxicity. Clémence is basically considered to be a, quote, woman of low morals and unsuited for motherhood.
Wow.
Yeah. If that gives you any indication of how the townspeople saw her. And that is actually a direct quote.
Jeez.
Her boyfriend, Gustav, is a considerable alcoholic with highly violent tendencies.
Gustav.
So that is a match made in heaven. And it's rumored in the small town, I mean, Le Mans is very tiny at this point, it's rumored that Clémence is having an affair with her boss. That doesn't matter, and she ends up pregnant. Gustav marries her in October of 1901 solely out of social obligation. So it was more or less a shotgun type of wedding. 5 months later, with zero celebration, the couple has a darling baby girl who they name Amelia. So the rumors are still swirling in the town that Clémence is still having sex with her boss. And Gustav, the raging alcoholic piece of shit that he is, grows increasingly jealous and angry. He would frequently verbally and physically abuse his wife and young daughter. So Gustav decides to end the affair by getting a job in another city, but Clémence pulls the, you know, the dramatic bullshit and says that she would commit suicide if he made her leave Le Mans. The marriage is pretty much at this point rapidly deteriorating into just a toxic cesspool. But nevertheless, because what's the best thing to do when you and your spouse are having just catastrophic issues?
Not be on birth control.
Become pregnant again.
Oh.
And so they give birth to another baby girl in 1905.
True story, I was actually just guessing, so.
And this baby girl, they name Christine. So between Gustav's alcoholism and Clémence having almost zero maternal instinct whatsoever, you know, remember, unsuited for motherhood, Christine is immediately sent to be raised by her aunt, Gustav's sister. That's definitely for the best, as the Pepin household is accustomed to acts of physical and verbal violence, molestation, and rape.
Where's CPS?
Right?
Did they not have one back then?
No, they did not have CPS. 6 years later, in 1911, the unhappy couple welcomed yet another baby girl, because you know things that, you know, they went to couples therapy and worked their previous shit out. Everything was so healthy. So they had a third child.
God.
This one they
You're
named...
using sarcasm, right?
Yes, I am using sarcasm before people get upset. So this child they named Leia. And shortly after Leia is born, Clémence discovers that Gustav had been repeatedly raping Amelia, their first daughter, now age 9.
No.
Terrible. Clémence immediately files for divorce. It's granted, and Amelia is packed up and sent off to a Catholic orphanage named Le Bon Pasteur.
Probably for the best.
Yes, 100%.
Oh, poor baby.
You see, Clémence was an absolute utter shitbag of a mother. She actually blamed Amelia, again, 9 years old, for seducing her own father.
Ugh.
Even though Clémence asked for and obtained a divorce from Gustav, she only wanted to do it because she wanted to be free of everyone. So to get further revenge on her own children, she sends word to Gustav's sister that Christine, now 6 years old, remember she was living with his sister, was to be sent to the same orphanage to join Amelia. Now, Christine had happily and safely lived with her paternal aunt for 6 years at that point.
Mm.
So Clémence wanted to wash her hands of maternal responsibility in full, and then sends Leia, the youngest, to live with an uncle because she was too young to go to the orphanage. So Clémence was like, getting a divorce and I'm just sending my children away, which is just terrible.
Well, it sounds like it's for the better, considering.
You would think, but oh, there's more. So the orphanage is also a convent, and it was not a nice place at all. Words cannot actually express that enough. I did a little further research into it, and it was known for taking in, quote, disgraced women and girls, but it was also known for its cold, loveless atmosphere and harsh punishments.
What's disgraced?
Women who have had children out of wedlock, homeless women, sex workers, you know, things of that nature.
And most of them probably aren't even guilty of that back then.
Right.
They just, like, probably looked at a man wrong. Mm-hmm. Oh, so fucked.
Yeah, no, it was really sad. Catholic orphanage and convent. You know, they did take in a lot of women and children. But it was known for just being very, you know what, I guess the stereotype that we grow up with, the non-Catholics, when you think of a Catholic school, how you have the nuns beating people with rulers and things like that. It was pretty much that. They were physically abused. For even the most minor things, it was very loveless. But the thing about it is that all sisters actually flourished in it, because I'm sure they had, like, they witnessed far worse shit at home.
They flourished
in it. So remember, Leia was living with her great uncle, and Amelia and Christine were both in the orphanage. So at this point, Amelia had taken her vows and officially become a nun, and Christine was planning to follow in her footsteps. Now, good old Clemence, their mother, received word that Christine was planning on becoming a nun and literally flew into a blind rage. She had planned for all three of her daughters to return when they were of a working age, age 15, and she had planned to find them jobs as live-in maids and take their money.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, that was her retirement plan.
Oh.
So, unfortunately to her, she deemed Amelia a lost cause because, you know, she officially is a nun now. Clemence removed Christine from the convent and brought her back to Le Mans, finding her jobs in local bourgeois households around the city. So, during all of this, Clemence's great uncle died. So, Leia was then sent to the same freaking orphanage, Le Bon Pasteur, where she stayed until she was 15. Again, legal age of employment is 15 years old at this time in 1900. So, what do you think happened? Clemence once again sends word to the convent, calling Leia home. And just like she had done with Christine, Clemence pushed Leia out into the community as a maid for hire. Aww. So, these poor children. Amelia was the only one who ended up having some semblance of an actual life.
Yeah.
Even though they had not grown up together, Leia and Christine immediately became inseparable, forming a tight-knit bond and spending every single minute together when they were not working. They even requested to work together when their employer was open to it.
Hmm.
It's kind of important to describe France at this time as well. So World War I had taken place from 1914 to 1918. France had over 1.3 million dead and an additional 3 million wounded.
Oh my God.
And almost 4 million casualties.
What?
Of, you know, limbs being blown off, things like that.
Well, I didn't even know that. I'm going to be honest. I'm not like a World War I buff. Like, I know.
Well, as a French major, this is like probably one of the most cataclysmic events in French history. It was absolutely devastating for the country and especially the economy. And that fallout ended up continuing through roughly around like 1932. So you have to kind of put into context that the fact that Leia and Christine were even able to work, yeah, you know, I mean, like any scraps of work was actually a pretty big fucking deal at this time.
No, that's pretty insane. Like, that's insane. I bet they had like no jobs, nothing.
Nothing. And this is the point when France was entering a Great Depression. France struggled to recover from the devastation of World War I. And if you recall from your history, Germany had given out war reparations, right? But here's the thing, is that that was fruitless for France because the French economy was based on small businesses and they didn't have a stock market, invested very little in the stock market.
Oh.
So it was just, suffice it to say, it was a shit show economy. And the girls, to survive, literally had to take almost anything they could. So here's where things start to head south.
Too bad they didn't have like Instacart or Uber or Lyft back then.
Uber with like a horse and buggy.
Oh, hell yeah. Living it up.
In 1926, Christine becomes a maid for the Lancelin family at 6 Rue Bruyere. Monsieur Lancelin is a well-respected attorney and his wife, Madame Lancelin, is a socialite. Their youngest daughter, Genevieve, lives at home with both of them, and her older sister basically married off and moved away. So the three of them live in this nice big, big home. After about 6 months of just stellar work, Christine convinces Madame Lancelin to bring Leia on as her chambermaid. So now both sisters live with the Lancelins in their home. They are treated exceptionally well, paid standard wages, and have ample time off. They share a very small upstairs bedroom that has a dresser and two twin beds, along with a heater. They had a heated bedroom, which was like, fuck yeah, they're staying at the Hilton.
Wow.
They even have a balcony overlooking the street, which was considered also very luxurious at the time.
Okay, yeah, like, people still think that.
Exactly.
So like, if you have a bedroom with a balcony, you're living pretty good.
Exactly. There are some oddities, though. And Monsieur Lancelin never spoke to the sisters. He actually never uttered a word to them in the years they worked with them. So Christine and Leah worked exceptionally hard, and the Lancelins actually frequently sung their praises, often complimenting them in front of dinner guests. So, you know, I'm sure that, that was pretty nice.
Yeah, I mean, that's way better than what they were dealing with in
at home.
Home and then the orphanage.
Exactly.
Like, someone's actually liking them and not being crazy and hurting them.
Exactly. In their time off, they only go to church on Sundays, to a local farmer's market, and also to a fortune teller.
What? I want to go to a fortune teller. Right?
Now, the fortune teller advises them that their souls had been bound together as husband and wife in a previous life, thus explaining their inexplicable bond.
That's not gross.
Right. But not everyone liked the sisters. So Christine is known as a hard worker and very, very intelligent, but also known to become petty and insubordinate at times. Leah is introverted and very obedient. Their bond, however, is starting to turn heads in town. Shopkeepers and former employers began gossiping and discussing how peculiar they are in their manner and describe their personas as cold and distant.
Weird.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But things are going great with the Lancelins. Madame Lancelin even becomes sort of a mother figure to the two girls. They call her Maman, or Mom, whereas they call their biological mother that woman.
Well, I would too. Fuck her.
Yeah. So recognizing that they were sending their wages back home to Clemence, Madame Lancelin advises the girls to cut her off completely. And Madame Lancelin actually went so far as to write their mother a letter, more or less pretty much telling her to fuck off and leave the girls alone. So obviously the family cared about them to some degree, right? If they were paying them well, helping them with finances, and even, you know, caring enough to tell their mother to stop abusing her via mail.
Yeah, please stop being abusive. Can you not do that?
Can you please leave them alone?
Yeah.
So
that woman.
That woman. So here we are 6 years later. Okay, and so this is late 1932. Madame Lancelin begins to succumb to mental illness. Her personality changes entirely. She goes from being a lighthearted socialite and mother figure to the two girls to physically and verbally abusing them. She develops extreme depression and scrutinizes everything they do.
What the hell?
Right?
Like, why?
She yells and screams at Christine and Leah, telling them they miss dirt while sweeping. She performs random white glove tests on the furniture to ensure that it had been dusted. She wakes them up in the middle of the night to pinch or slap them.
What?
If their work wasn't up to her expectations. If there was a button out of place on their blouses or a hem sagging, she would slap them. She starts to wake them up in the middle of the night to scrub the kitchen. One time, she apparently made them scrub the kitchen 3 times, only to bring the trash in and dump it all over the floor just to make them do it again.
That's really messed up, and I need someone to clean my kitchen. But 3 times, that's excessive, man.
And in the middle of the night,
no kitchen's that important.
The abuse apparently got so bad that she would slam their heads against the walls whenever they did anything that did not suit her. One night, completely tired of the abuse, Leah tells Christine that if the abuse continues, she would fight back and defend herself. So they weren't going to put up with it anymore, and put up with it anymore, they did not.
Oh.
A year later, on February 2nd, 1933, it all comes to a head. The day was dark, cold, and rainy. Madame Lancelin and her daughter Genevieve go out clothes shopping for a dinner party later that evening that the family is planning to attend. Monsieur Lancelin goes into his office as usual with plans to basically go to the party directly from work, meeting up with his wife and daughter. So once Madame Lancelin and Genevieve return home, they first notice that all of the lights are off. Madame Lancelin calls to the sisters to inquire about the darkness, and they explain that the power outage was due to a faulty iron that Christine had plugged in on a previous day. The repairs for that blown fuse had been deducted from their collective pay. Can you imagine, like, plugging in someone's shit iron and it sparking and then them charging you for the fix? For the repair?
Okay, like, I'd be calling the warranty company. I'd be like...
That existed.
Yeah, no, I'm kidding. It's like going to work and then their oven goes out and you get charged for it.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what happened. they explain that it was due to the faulty iron that they plugged in, and Madame Lancelin just absolutely loses her ever-loving shit and flies into a white rage. She begins to beat and slap both Christine and Leia on the first floor landing. Huh. So Christine grabs a pewter jug and then smashes it over Madame Lancelin's head. Genevieve, the daughter, then jumps into the fight trying to protect her mother. Christine grabs Genevieve screaming, "I'm going to massacre them," and gouges and plucks out Genevieve's eyes.
What? Mm-hmm. How do you... Okay, I'm not going to lie to you. I've always wondered how, like in horror movies and stuff, how do you successfully just pluck an eye out?
I'm assuming she just got her fingers down in there and pulled it out by the...
Oh.
So Leia holds off further attacks by Madame Lancelin, and Christine orders her to, quote, smash her head into the ground, tear her eyes out. And Leia did. She gouged out Madame Lancelin's eyes as well.
Oh, that's hardcore.
So now that their employers are seriously injured and lacking all of their eyes, the two sisters go into the kitchen to look for additional weapons.
Is that necessary at that point? Right? Is it necessary? Like, someone doesn't have eyes.
Well, they collect a hammer and a knife.
Oh.
The Pepin sisters then beat and stab the Lancelin women for roughly 2 hours.
2 hours?
When the mother and daughter finally die from their torture, Christine and Leia prepare their corpses just like they would wild game. Later on, Christine would recount that she, quote, was just following a recipe for a rabbit dish from an old cookbook. They butchered them, they gutted them, and then mutilated their genitals.
What?
They even used Genevieve's menstrual blood as a sort of base, rubbing it all over her and her mother.
Ugh.
Yeah. Later that evening, Daddy Lancelin returns to the residence and is greeted by a locked door. He came home. So remember, his plan was to go directly to the party and not stop home? Well, he decided to stop at home first. The door was locked, the lights were off. So he just immediately assumes, okay, well, my wife and kid are at the party, I'll head over there. He goes to the party. Of course, they have not arrived yet. He becomes worried, so he and a friend travel back to his home. Again, the home is still dark, except for a single candle burning upstairs in the Pepin sister's room. Without entering, the two men walk to the closest police department and bring an officer back with them.
Oh, of course.
So he doesn't have to, you know, break open the door, and it's obviously looking a little shady.
Yeah.
As the officer enters the residence through the garden, he shines his flashlight into the home. The light settles on a single eyeball that's lying on the ground in a pool of blood. So at this point, everyone's like, what the fuck?
I can't imagine coming home and being like, there's an eyeball on my floor.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
I'd be like, I'm walking away. Everyone else can find out what's going on. I'm not going to see this.
Right? No, exactly. So he continues into the home and discovers the scene of the crime at the top of the stairs on the second floor. Madame Lancelin and her daughter are mutilated beyond recognition. And there is actually a picture of this. I will include it because it is one of the big pictures from the cases of their bodies. I'll include it on our website, wesawthedevil.com, in the case file for this episode. It's absolutely insane. Now, Madame Lancelin's eyeballs are found draped around her neck inside of a scarf. One of Genevieve's had already been discovered downstairs, and the other one is underneath her body. Fearing that the sisters had met a similarly grisly fate, the officer continues up the stairs to their room. The door is locked, but he hears hushed voices speaking. He repeatedly knocks at the door, but no one will answer, even though he knows that they're inside. He calls for a locksmith to open the door. An hour later, the locksmith arrives, opens the door, and inside, they find the Pepin sisters, naked in bed, kissing and holding one another. A blood and brain-covered hammer rests on the nightstand beside them. They immediately confess to the murders, but claim self-defense.
They fucking lost their minds.
Yeah. So... The Pepin sisters are immediately imprisoned and separated from one another. They both act out and call and cry for one another constantly. Christine becomes so distressed and suicidal that she tries to tear her own eyes out as well.
What
is it with eyes in this case?
I don't know, but there's going to be a lot of people who are like, no, just no, 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 no.
Yeah. So Christine had violent fits, horrible hallucinations. She attacked guards, went on a hunger strike, and she's eventually put into a straitjacket just to keep her from self-harming.
Wow.
The prison officials actually kind of felt bad for them, And so they finally allowed them to see each other for a short visit, only for them to immediately begin kissing. Christine rapidly tried to undress Leia, unbuttoning her blouse, and was begging, please say yes.
What?
So you can imagine the shock, awe, and probably visible disgust that these officers felt. Now, the case ended up going to the courts, right? Inevitably. Over 40 journalists come from Paris, with even more coming from other cities across the country. So we're talking 1933. So 40 journalists coming from Paris, with even more coming from across the country. That's a lot. And France has actually always allowed quite a bit of tabloid fanfare surrounding criminal cases. So you know how England and a lot of other European countries even have more tabloids than we do?
Yes.
So the pair is known as the Criminal Sisters. And a mob of people surround the courthouse, an absolute mob, and they demand their execution by guillotine.
Oh my God.
Now at this point in 1933, no woman had been guillotined since 1887. And this entire like group of people were calling for them to be executed that way. The defense argues that the sisters went temporarily insane. As evidence, they cite a cousin who died in asylum, a grandfather prone to violent attacks, and an uncle who committed suicide as evidence of a hereditary disposition toward insanity.
I think that's a pretty compelling case.
Right. Experts at the time ruled that the siblings had succumbed to a condition known as folie à deux, or madness of two. And basically, it's a type of shared psychosis. Such a condition presents as a variety of symptoms like paranoia, hearing voices, inventing fictitious threats that somehow require self-defense, and even unusual sexual behavior.
That's,
And there was a true crime magazine at the time called Allo Police, and it actually managed to interview the sisters, and it provided the very first report on the incestuous nature of their relationship.
Wow.
Which was really interesting.
Yeah.
The article called Christine, quote, the masculine one, and referred to Leia as her mistress.
What?
And this ties into the stereotype behind the assertion that the pair had succumbed to folie à deux, or the madness of two. It pretty much pointed out that they had an unnatural, taboo, incestuous relationship, and this also became a lot of homosexual relationships, how people always try to say one's masculine, one's feminine.
Or who's the man?
Who's the man?
Which one's the man?
They try to actually play into that false stereotype. So fun stuff there. The Allo Police did not help their case. The court decides that the sisters were sane and therefore guilty. Christine Pépin is sentenced to be put to death by guillotine in the public square at Le Mans on September 30th, 1933. Leia Pépin, you know, the mistress, the feminine one, is considered an accomplice and just given a lighter sentence of 10 years hard labor. So while Christine waited in her holding cell for punishment, she became completely unhinged again.
Do they like deem that crazy woman as like being uglier than the other one?
Yes, they did. They actually called her ugly. And you'll see pictures of them and whatnot and on our website, and it's sad. But Christine, right, the older one, she became unhinged and tried to, what did she try to do?
Gouge her eyes out?
Yes, again, in 1934.
Are we kidding? Are we kidding? Can we stay away from our eyes, people? Like, come on.
So on January 22nd, 1934, President Albert Lebrun, the president, issued a stay of execution for Christine, and her sentence was commuted to life imprisonment in an asylum. She soon began to starve herself in a hunger strike over not being able to see Leia, and she died of it as a result on May 18th, 1937.
Oh, Jesus.
Leia Pépin was released only after 8 years on good behavior in 1941. She then went to reside with her mother, Clémence.
That woman?
That woman. She went to go reside with that woman and lived a long and quiet life under assumed name, working again as a maid in local homes.
Was her mom living off of her?
Probably.
Oh.
Let's fast forward to present day, actually, in the year 2000. While making the documentary In Search of the Pépin Sisters, French filmmaker Claude Ventura found Leia living in a hospice center in France. The woman had suffered a stroke and was partially paralyzed and unable to speak. But there is one single photograph of this gray-haired woman, and many people confirm that is actually Leia Pépin.
Oh, really?
And she ended up dying in 2001.
2001?
Yeah.
Damn, she lived forever.
She had a very, very long life. France had just like a tremendous amount of tabloid fanfare. The president even called it one of the worst crimes France has ever seen. And I'm like, do you guys remember the French Revolution? But okay. Like, hello. Like Jean-Paul Sartre, de Beauvoir, Jean Genet, they all held up the crime as an example of class warfare, that this crime mirrored a system in which figures like servants lived in terrible conditions and their high-class employers enjoyed everything, which, I mean, no shit, Sherlock.
Modern day America.
They even became very popular like centerpieces in Communist Party magazines. The Communist Party magazines and publications framed them as victims of class oppression. And then we have a lot of media, right? So there have been to this day over 50 theatrical productions on this case.
50?
Over 50 across the world, like large scale. In 2013, Benedict Andrews and with Andrew Upton co-authored a new version being used in London on Broadway. It was kind of a copy of an Australian version, but it actually starred Cate Blanchett and Isabelle Huppert as the maids. So we're talking basically Oscar-winning actresses starring as the sisters.
I mean, I know Cate Blanchett.
Yeah.
Not personally. I'd like to know her personally, but I don't.
So there have been over 50 theatrical productions and over... God, at this point, over 30 feature-length films made about the pair. Some of those include Murderous Maids, Sister My Sister, A Judgment in Stone, and you can actually see and read more about those, but the list goes on and on and on. I was just really, truly fascinated by this case. So also, don't forget, the only survivor, right, was Monsieur Lancelin of all of this.
Yeah.
And he was unable to sell his home after the murder, and he lived in his home with a housekeeper until his death 20 years later.
Sounds like something out of American Horror Story.
Right?
Like, except for the, like, maid didn't die, you know? Mm-hmm.
If you ever want to, you know, go to Le Mans and take a tour, it's on Brière Street, and it is the only one that does not have a street number. Oh. They actually removed the number entirely.
It sounds like the cheese. The name, everything I hear in France and their name of their streets just makes me think of cheese.
I know. I love Gruyere cheese. But yeah, Gruyere. Because so many people were coming to the home to get a glimpse of it, they actually took the number off of it entirely.
Oh, that's crazy.
Like, legally, they took the number off the home.
What?
And it's apparently changed hands only a couple times since 1930.
So are we serious?
It's likely speculated that it's been kept in the family.
Oh, probably, yeah. That's crazy. That's some inherited wealth, I guess.
Yep.
Or maybe not anymore. Who knows? Thank you for sharing that story. That's crazy. That's madness. Like, eye gouging.
Incest. And there's been so much speculation, right? Because the Monsieur Lancelin lived for 20 years after his family was murdered. And don't forget that he had one other daughter survive, right? She was married and living out of the house. But there's been like letters and stuff that he wrote to family about them. It's been published. And there's speculation that Genevieve, the daughter that was murdered, actually caught the two sisters having sex. Or noticed that they had an incestuous relationship.
And then started abusing them.
Or called them out on it. I mean, that would have been, you know, really, really socially
in my head, that's what happened.
It's all speculative, but that is in fact what happened, and I think it is insane.
No, I agree.
That is it for this episode, guys. If you have any questions or additional resources, email us at wesawthedevil@gmail.com. So next week, we're going to be starting our first episode in a 6-part series on Joseph James D'Angelo. And if that name doesn't ring a bell, it's because he was arrested not terribly long ago for the crimes of the East Area Rapist. You may know him as the original Night Stalker, Golden State Killer. He goes by many names.
Because he's committed many crimes.
Like,
in many places.
Many crimes, many places, many names, and
over a long period of time.
Got so ungodly evil.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you get when you have someone who's an ex-cop, knows his way around the system, I guess.
I have been obsessed with this case. I was on the web sleuth boards for years. And I actually had spoken with Michelle McNamara, too, online back in the day as she was doing research and became obsessed with it as well.
We actually listened to the audiobook as we were driving on the Golden State Highway.
Yes, that is actually moving across the country, going up the Golden State Highway and listening to Michelle McNamara's I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Yeah, that was what an incredible book. This was before they caught the Asteria rapist, or however you'd like to call him. So we were really like into it and doing the research and just like being like, when are they going to catch this guy?
Lo and behold, then he was.
Yeah, no, he's been caught, and nothing's worse than somebody like him playing the old frail man who just could not do harm. And meanwhile, he's like,
there's nothing worse than like a man who tries to show up in his first court appearance, trying to play the I'm a frail old man. And literally like the week before, he was going 70 miles an hour through the interstates of Sacramento on a crotch rocket. So we have a lot to talk about with him. We're going to break it up into six different pieces and kind of do just a very thorough deep dive on each phase that he went through and, you know, kind of almost like each name that he had. Cordova Cat Burglar, Visalia Ransacker. God, he was a flasher at one point.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Actually, I'm sorry. Like, maybe I missed that memo, but...
Yeah. So it's going to be a six-part series, and we're going to start with episode one, which is just kind of like a full overview. So we will have that coming out next Thursday.
Stay tuned, and until next crime.
Yes, until next crime.